News. Today is Tuesday, December 1st, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, how one Ethiopian doctor is trying to help refugees from his country's civil war.
He says when they arrived here, they realized they need to make a clinic to help their people.
Also ahead, today is World AIDS Day.
We are way off the targets of actually getting control of HIV transmission.
Plus, deforestation in the Amazon rainforest reaches a 12-year high. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Ethiopia, where Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has struck a victorious tone since government forces captured the capital of the northern Tigray region over the weekend. The capture of Mekele followed weeks of fighting against the Tigray People's Liberation Front, but Ethiopia's civil war may not be over just yet. To understand where things stand and what might happen next, I reached out to William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. William, what is the state of play right now in Tigray?
Well, I think the claim by the federal government is obviously, you know, looks well-founded. The federal forces seem to be in control of major Tigrayan cities and have made, you know, very significant territorial gains since the war started, you know, culminating in moving into Mekele. But we do not seem to have had any major urban warfare. So it looks like the Tigrayan leadership and whatever state the Tigrayan forces in, you know, they've withdrawn from Mekele. We do know those forces have been, you know, overpowered and outnumbered to some extent by the federal forces, but the leadership, Tigrayan leadership, has committed to keep fighting. So now it's the question of, you know, what state are those Tigrayan security forces in? What level of support do they have from the broader Tigrayan governing establishment and the society?
Now, the big reason why the government launched this offensive after the fighting first broke out was to capture the TPLF leadership. So where do things stand in terms of that goal?
Well, I think we have to assume that the absolute priority next for the federal government, the federal forces, is to capture those Tigrayan government and military officers who are on the arrest warrant list. As far as we know, none of them have been captured yet. You know, along with that, there will be this attempt to maintain and extend security control and then begin to establish this provisional government, which will administer Tigray in place of the former regional government. You know, I think in terms of that manhunt, we hear it's ongoing, but no successes yet. And there are reports of continued clashes. So we will have to see how that unfolds. And then this provisional government will be set up. And the plan there is to sort of, you know, to work with the lower structures of Tigray's government and replace the upper tiers. And again, that will be a question of, you know, just how will Tigray's existing political establishment react to this federal intervention and the government imposed from Addis Ababa.
And there have been calls for opening humanitarian access to the region. Abiy himself said he will be doing that. Has there been any movement on that?
Not much movement so far on that issue, to my understanding, in the vast majority of Tigray. Obviously, the access will open up first in the areas where the federal government establishes the most control. But, you know, that control, as we understand it, extends, you know, to main roads, major cities, I guess areas around, you know, peripheral areas of Tigray, you know, such as maybe West Tigray, where the intervention sort of first occurred. And then my understanding is that, yes, the government is obviously looking to get in humanitarian support as well as reestablish government services, but they will be looking to very tightly manage that access for humanitarian agencies. So it will be difficult. And if there is, you know, an ongoing security situation and essentially, you know, some form of developing insurgency, then obviously that could well cause serious complications in terms of the aid operation.
You know, it's hard to tell because there isn't access, but do we have any indications of what military capabilities the TPLF still has? You know, it's claimed that it shot down a plane, or can it launch rockets to Eritrea or elsewhere, or even just whether it still has the fuel and ammunition to fight an insurgency. What do we know?
Well, I think there are signs that it still has those missile launches and missiles, with those directed at Asmara on Saturday, I believe. And there's also a suggestion that it's got still got a certain amount of firepower and heavy weaponry. But obviously, it's very hard to verify that. It's also, you know, hard to tell, you know, just what sort of losses both sides have had. We have nothing. We have no ballpark fatality casualty figure yet. So, you know, that will be obviously be very important for the state of the Tigrayan security forces. We expect supply lines still to be a major issue, particularly fuel. You know, the sort of bullish supporters of the Tigrayan resistance, they will talk about the ability to capture fuel from the enemy as they defeat them. But of course, we'll have to see about that. And then perhaps the continued armed resistance might be in a stronger position in terms of their sort of hold on the countryside and plenty of support from local militia. But then at the same time, if the provisional government is able to sort of get up and running, then maybe it will be able to exert some control over the countryside, you know, through the sort of levers of the government and the state and food distribution and that type of thing.
That's William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. William, thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
The conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region has pushed tens of thousands of people into refugee camps in neighboring Sudan, where aid groups are struggling to provide care. But one Tigrayan doctor who fled the fighting has set up a clinic in the Hashaba refugee camp in Al-Gadarif, Sudan, which is where Naba Mohiddin sent us this report.
Internal medicine specialist Daryl Logosh was a well-known doctor in Hemura city in Ethiopia before he fled to Sudan this month. Gush and other colleagues displaced from Ethiopia have now established a small clinic in the Hashaba refugee camp, east of Sudan's Al-Gadarif city, to help those in need of medical attention. The clinic has no tools to diagnose or shelves on which to stock medicine, yet refugee doctors are eager to help despite challenging circumstances. He says when they arrived here, they realized the need to make a clinic to help their people. The Al-Gadarif State Bureau gave them some medicine to start working, but what they have is essential medication for primary health care. Gush adds that people with acute diseases like tuberculosis, diabetes, heart failure, and HIV have no medications. There is also no laboratory for diagnosis. The Hashaba camp has nearly 16,000 refugees. Women and children represent 70% of the arrivals, according to the camp administration. A 4-meter-size room is given to every family, and certain rooms are dedicated to those with chronic diseases. This clinic member notes that many fled Ethiopia without the medicines they require. Gilbert Sadik said, "A lot of people left Humara, Maikadra, Barakat, and Western Tigray. There are many people with HIV, tuberculosis, diabetes, and high blood pressure. They left their drugs because of the war and are without any of their medications." Many international and Sudanese organizations are working to help the refugees' fragile health situation and are calling for a larger intervention. Hashim says due to their work in refugee health care, they noticed a variety of fatal and acute diseases. They are sending a message to international civil society organizations to provide aid and tools so they can protect people and control the possible spread of the diseases. Hashaba camp director Mustafa Anwar is also putting out a call for help. Mustafa says the heavy influx into the camp in the Hashaba region has reached 15,557 amid tough economic conditions in Sudan. He calls on international health organizations to quickly intervene as people are in a state of emergency. Sudanese authorities have reported fewer new arrivals in recent days due to the closure of some borders on the Ethiopian side and the escalating turmoil in the Tigray region. Naba Mohiddin for VOA News, Hashaba Refugees Camp, Al-Gadarif.
Now we head to India, where tens of thousands of farmers have set up protest camps outside Delhi. The farmers oppose legislation that deregulates the country's agricultural industry by removing price guarantees. Small farmers say the changes would benefit larger agricultural companies at their expense. But right-wing Prime Minister Narendra Modi has so far not backed down on the legislation. For more, I reached out to journalist Anjana Pasrika in Delhi. Anjana, thank you for joining us. First of all, can you give us an idea of what these protest camps are like outside the city, and also what effect they're having on Delhi?
The farmers actually, as you see, are camped in huge numbers at several border entry points into Delhi. That's because they were denied permission to enter the city and protest at an iconic site where they wanted to sit. Of course, there were scenes of police firing tear gas shells and water cannons on the farmers a few days ago. But now they're basically camped there, and they're saying that we will not go back until we are allowed to enter the city and to register our protest against the three laws that they want rolled back.
And now let's talk about these laws. What do these laws say?
Yeah, these three laws were passed by Parliament in September. They basically set aside a decades-old system for selling crops in India, under which farmers used to sell their crops at government-regulated markets where a minimum price was set. Now, this is especially true for rice and wheat, which are grown in huge quantities in North India. Most of the protesting farmers, you know, come from North India. The new laws will allow them to sell their produce directly anywhere. Theoretically, a free market should be good. But the farmers fear that dismantling the government-regulated system will open them to exploitation by the private sector and would actually push down prices. So their main demand is that the government should continue to set minimum prices for about 24 crops, major crops such as rice, wheat, and oil seeds.
And how has the Prime Minister responded to this? It seems so far like he's really held firm, that he's not backing down. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Prime Minister Narendra Modi gave a speech yesterday in his parliamentary constituency of Varanasi. And he repeated what he has said earlier, that these new laws will be a game changer for India's huge agriculture sector. He tried to reassure farmers that the reforms will, in fact, improve their incomes. They will draw in private investment, you know, basically modernize agriculture and help them get better prices for their crops. You know, he's called these reforms historic. So have actually several observers. He blamed opposition parties for stoking their fears. But I've spoken to a few farmers today, and the farmers remain adamant and unconvinced. And they say they will not budge on their demand that the government continue with the practice of setting floor prices for crops.
And last of all, Anjana, let's talk about the politics. How serious is this protest movement in terms of opposition to Modi? Does it threaten his government's popularity or his political power in any way?
Prime Minister Modi is, of course, as you know, hugely popular in India and won by a huge mandate. However, these are some of the biggest farm protests we have seen. And half of India depends on agriculture. We have 150 million families that depend on farming. So any erosion of support among the rural areas and among farmers will impact his government. To what extent, it's too early to say.
That's journalist Anjana Pasricha in Delhi. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Anjana.
Thank you, Jason.
This is VOA. In Iran, a draft bill requiring the government to pursue uranium enrichment of 20% and to disregard other restraints put on its nuclear program in 2015 cleared its first hurdle in Parliament today. The legislation was proposed in the wake of the assassination of a top nuclear scientist Friday, and the Parliament cleared the draft on the first reading in a session broadcast live on state radio. The bill still must be approved in a second reading and be endorsed by a clerical body before it becomes law. And in Vietnam today, authorities reported two more coronavirus cases linked to a new domestic infection in Ho Chi Minh City, which is the country's business hub. The Southeast Asian nation is back on high alert after authorities yesterday confirmed the country's first community infection in 89 days and shut down several places in the densely populated city. Vietnam has registered a total of 1,349 coronavirus cases with 35 deaths. And in Hong Kong, leader Carrie Lam today urged residents to stay at home and avoid unnecessary family gatherings as the global financial hub scrambles to contain a new rise in COVID-19 cases. Today, Hong Kong reported 82 new cases, bringing the total in the city of 7.4 million people to 6,397 since the epidemic started, with 109 deaths. While there has been a ban on gatherings of more than four people, larger groups of residents have been widely seen together across the territory, especially on weekends and public holidays, although it's rare to see anyone without a face mask. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. 4 years ago, governments around the world committed to UN goals that would end the AIDS pandemic. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us why these goals haven't been met so far, but how one major city succeeded.
The world has had the tools to end AIDS for the past decade. Anti-AIDS drugs make it nearly impossible for those who are positive to pass the virus to someone else. There are also drugs that people with a high risk of acquiring HIV can take to prevent transmission. 4 years ago, governments around the world committed to achieving three targets: diagnosing 90% of those who have HIV, treating 90% of those diagnosed, and suppressing the virus to undetectable levels in 90% of those being treated. Yet experts say we aren't even close to those goals. Dr. Chris Byrer has spent the past 30 years researching HIV/AIDS. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins.
2020 was supposed to be the year in which we were going to see really significant declines in new infections, down under 500,000 worldwide. And we had more than 1.7 million new infections in 2019. So we are way off the targets of actually getting control of HIV transmission.
Byrer says teenagers and young adults are especially vulnerable.
We're still seeing that people acquire HIV when they're relatively young, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but also true in the United States and true in Latin America and the Caribbean, East Asia, Southeast Asia. And then they are not starting therapy until quite a bit later.
This is a huge problem for young men, Byrer says. They don't normally see doctors and are not likely to be tested until they develop symptoms. As a result, they die sooner than women with HIV, and they have had years to pass the virus to their partners, he adds. HIV thrives in countries where it's a crime to be a sex worker, or to be gay or transgender, where IV drug users are punished, or where these groups are stigmatized. More than 60% of new HIV infections are in these groups. New York City achieved the UN goals through a program that expanded health care to include those at risk of getting HIV. Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis headed the AIDS program at the city's health department.
Much of what we did in New York City with ending the epidemic came directly from communities. Like, for instance, the work that we did with transgender-led organizations, like we literally listened to what the transgender-led organizations needed, and we designed something to fit that need.
Daskalakis says that AIDS prevention succeeded in New York because health services focused on providing care and not on the identities of those being served. Daskalakis will soon oversee the HIV/AIDS program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He says he feels confident that the U.S. can achieve similar results by listening to what different groups need. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
In Brazil, official government data showed today that deforestation in the country's Amazon rainforest region surged to a 12-year high this year, with destruction soaring since President Jair Bolsonaro took office and weakened environmental protections. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Deforestation in Brazil's Amazon rainforest has skyrocketed to a 12-year high in 2020. Government data released on Monday showed more than 11,000 square kilometres have been wiped away. That's a patch of roughly seven times the size of London taken out of the world's largest rainforest. And it's also up 10% from 2019. This year, fires have blazed through the Amazon and environmentalists have blamed the government. The devastation tracks with the time since President Jair Bolsonaro took office. Bolsonaro has weakened Brazil's environmental agency and called for more commercial farming and mining, arguing it will lift the region out of poverty. Critics say this has encouraged illegal ranchers, miners, and land grabbers to clear the forest. The rate of destruction means Brazil will miss its own target to stop deforestation, that it set over a decade ago under a climate change law. It's not clear what consequences there will be for missing that goal. But federal officials say the latest figures are actually progress. Technically, 2019 saw a much higher jump in the rate of deforestation, even though the amount of forest destroyed in 2020 is at decade highs. And on Monday, Vice President Hamilton Mourão said that was a sign efforts to fight deforestation were, quote, beginning to bear fruit. The destruction of the Amazon has caused international outrage. As the world's largest rainforest, its protection is crucial for stopping climate change because of the vast amounts of carbon dioxide it absorbs.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan. In the Netherlands, environmental activists took Royal Dutch Shell to court today as they demand the energy firm drastically reduce the production of oil and gas to limit its effects on climate change. Seven activist groups, including Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth Netherlands, filed the lawsuit in April last year on behalf of more than 17,000 Dutch citizens who say the oil giant is threatening human rights as it continues to invest billions in the production of fossil fuels. They demand that Shell cut its greenhouse gas emissions almost in half by 2030 and to by zero by 2050, which would effectively force the Anglo-Dutch firm to quickly move away from oil and gas and direct its investments to sustainable sources of energy. Shell has repeatedly said it agreed that action to fight climate change was needed, but that this court case would not help. In the U.S., civil rights groups are applauding a ruling by a New York federal judge that newly detained immigrants must be presented in court within 10 days of being apprehended, not months. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Immigration advocates say Judge Allison Nathan's ruling is the first time U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has been ordered to provide prompt access to a judge, more important because of COVID-19 spreading in detention facilities. Judge Nathan said while detainees may not have a fundamental right to be released during removal proceedings, the government does not have an unfettered right to detain them. In 2014, the average wait to see a judge was 11 days. More recently, it's been around 3 months. One migrant, Shamar Michel, said ICE officers told him he'd be home by dinner time when they took him from his children, but it was 6 weeks before he got to see a judge. I'm Jackie Quinn.
That's it for our show today. Thank you for listening. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the virtual 2020 Afghanistan conference, Undersecretary for Political Affairs David Hale pledged $300 million in U.S. civilian assistance for 1 year and said, "Our common goal is an Afghanistan at peace with itself and its neighbors, respectful of the human rights of all its citizens, and capable of ensuring terrorists can never again use Afghan soil to threaten the security of America and our allies." The United States is committed to maintaining and advancing the gains achieved in Afghanistan since 2001. These include respect for the rights of all Afghans, including women, youth, and minority groups, adherence to the rule of law, respect for international obligations, and inclusive, transparent, and accountable government. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stressed that the government of Afghanistan must also do its part to implement stability and security.
I'm talking about things like economic reforms, real anti-corruption efforts, including our drug interdiction, respect for human rights, including religious freedom, a welcome environment for the private sector, and steps towards self-reliance.
Secretary Pompeo stated firmly that the choices made in peace negotiations will affect the size and scope of future international support and assistance. "The international community also has a role to play," said Secretary Pompeo, "especially Afghanistan's neighbors, to help that country toward a more peaceful, secure and sustainable future." The United States announced its pledge of $300 million in civilian assistance to Afghanistan in 2021, with a condition that a remaining $300 million will only be made available as we review progress in the peace process, explained Undersecretary Hale. "We all have a stake in the future of Afghanistan and in ensuring a more peaceful, secure, and sustainable future for its people," said Undersecretary Hale. "The government of Afghanistan must do its part, and the Afghan Afghan